You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of Commentary. Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Goldie Hawn.
And today we are going to take a look at Nicholas Meyer's career as a director on the whole, recapping all of his movies, which we have just covered over the past couple months. So before we get started, here's an interesting little fact which I just learned this very instant. Nicholas Meyer was born on Christmas Eve, 1945, in New York City.
Yeah.
The very next day, Christmas Day, 1945, in the same city.
A child was born?
Another child was born.
On Christmas Day?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously that's Jesus.
Rick Berman.
I was pretty close.
All right, so what we're going to do is look at each of his movies. We'll just go through, give our opinion, and then recap his career on the whole.
Yep.
His first movie was 1979, after a few of his books had been written, and a few of his movies had been written. It was released in 1979.
It wasn't called 1979.
No, it was called Time After Time.
Yep.
This was the Jack the Ripper, H.G. Wells time travel story.
Right.
Which
H.G. Wells travels back in time to rescue whales from Jack the Ripper.
Yes. So what did you think of Time After Time?
It's extremely dated. It's unfortunate, sort of a problem of traveling to present day with a time machine. You almost invariably end up making it more dated by pretending that the present day is somehow exotic. And then you realize that it's actually rather mundane, and all of the changes that have occurred since then make that moment in history look extremely specific to that one moment.
I guess so. You know, I can forgive that because, I mean, I guess I've seen enough movies from the time period and whatever that I know how things were back in the late 70s. But on the whole, I thought it was a really good movie. I guess it didn't hold up as much for me this time around as it did the first time around. But I do still like it quite a bit. I think it's a lot of fun.
Time after time, it's less good than the last time?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
But I do still enjoy it, and I am still fascinated by the Star Trek IV similarities. In 1982, Meyer released his second movie, which was a gig that he got, I think, based on the success of Time After Time, and that was Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
I've seen that.
Or Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, as it was originally entitled.
Star Trek Into The Wrath of Khan.
What did you think about The Wrath of Khan?
It's easily the best Star Trek movie. And it's one of the best movies ever made. I don't know exactly how many deep it would be, but maybe not top 10, but top 30 for sure.
Yeah, I agree that it's an excellent movie. One of the best ever made, sure. I would put it at number 3 in my Star Trek list. But yeah, I do think that it's an excellent movie for all the reasons that everyone else does. I think it is really interesting that it was made by a guy who hadn't really even watched Star Trek very much, let alone been a fan. But I think that's also what the franchise needed at the time.
I mean, that's essentially his particular weird superpower, his ability to understand a body of work and work within it without being disruptive, but somehow also able to more clearly define it and better exemplify its characteristics and merits.
Yeah, you know, his love for Sherlock Holmes, I think it leads to his respect for pre-existing continuities and, you know, that whole thing. So even though he is not a fan of Star Trek, I think that he appreciates Star Trek fandom and knows that it's important to be true to what has come before. A year later, 1983, he made a movie for television called The Day After, mm-hmm. which is the most watched television movie of all time and always will be. It is about what happens after the bombs are dropped in a nuclear war.
Is that why they called it that?
I think
The Day After the Bombs Are Dropped in the Nuclear War?
Mm-hmm.
So it is a long title, but now it makes sense.
Well, what did you think of The Day After?
You know, it's surprisingly good considering it's a TV movie. At a certain point, the narrative becomes extremely tight and focused and really well paced. The first 40 minutes or so are not; they're very sort of TV movie pacing, and then it gets really good once everything turns bad. And as things get worse, the movie becomes very well everythinged. Edited, shot, performed, it all hums very well.
I think that's kind of the nature of the story. You know, I mean, you've got to do that sort of cliche stuff at the beginning in order to make the end as impactful as possible.
I mean, to me, that's like Emmerich school, you know, like start the movie by showing everybody, all these little people, show their lives and how they're normal, relatable people. I know they're normal people. I don't assume that because he's in a movie that, in addition to being a guy who works at the docks, he's also a spy. So why do you need to tell me that he's a normal guy? Why do you need to show me like 10 minutes of him interacting with his kids to inform that he has kids?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very clunky, and I would like it if people stopped bothering with that nonsense.
Well, you know, I mean, it depends. It's, I mean, a lot of that, there's so many characters and everything that I think that, you know, the obvious goal is to build them up as much as possible, make them as fully fleshed out as you can. I mean, you hear this type of thing in regards to horror movies all the time. Like, mm-hmm. we spend, you know, an hour on the characters so that when they start dying, you really care about them.
There's a significant difference in that there you're trying to create, you know, fully fleshed out characters that are real people, whereas The Day After, it's really more stereotypical character types. Like, there's the doctor. There's the boyfriend, there's the daughter, there's the husband and the wife, and they're not unique. They're not, like, significantly distinct from those stereotypical aspects of those characters. So you don't really need an introduction to all of them. And it would actually make a great deal more sense if you focused on just one group of those and had the various interactions that occur later occur as they would. People you never met before, you'd suddenly bump into during the end of the world. That would make sense.
I mean, that'd be one way to go about it. You know, this is another way. I don't think that, you know, one way is necessarily more effective, you know, inherently than another.
I do.
Okay. Well, I did like The Day After quite a bit. I was actually kind of surprised, like you were saying, that this is a TV movie. It seems like something that, I mean, I guess they got away with it in that it was an important topic at the time, and people were willing
it's
to accept
it. It's still an important
things.
Topic.
Well, sure. But it does feel like something that you wouldn't normally see on network television. It, you know, I could see, like, HBO these days doing something like that, but I can't imagine it showing up on ABC, so you got to give them credit for that. And, you know, on the whole, I think it plays to television strengths in that it, you know, focuses on people and doesn't have, you know, outrageous effects-driven plots or anything like that. It's just a very simple story about the end of the world. And I thought it was really effective. It scared me. Well, 2 years later, Meyer returned to the big screen with Volunteers, starring Tom Hanks, which is a comedy about a spoiled rich kid who goes to Southeast Asia to build a bridge for the Peace Corps, and in the process realizes that maybe he's not helping out the people who he thinks he's helping out, but actually helping out other people who probably shouldn't be helped out.
Well, I mean, there's a the aspect of the story that you allude to, the idea that he's helping other people. I mean, there are the two parties that are both in competition with each other, but they both greatly desire the bridge because the criminal guys, they want to move drugs, and that would greatly help them with transportation costs, and the communist expansionists would like the bridge so that they could expand communism. And the reaction to both sides is essentially, oh no, that would be bad. But the entire movie is sort of like, it's sort of focused on this one guy and his contribution, his feeling of trying to help because he's never done it before. That in a way makes it less awkward, that no resolution would actually be particularly good. It's more or less a situation where by the time you're seeing these characters, the wheels are already far too well in motion to stop something from happening. So his involvement really doesn't improve the situation or make it worse in any way.
Well, but it's told from his perspective. It's about his personal journey more than anything.
Yeah, and his personal journey is he goes from not really caring about how other people live or feel to not wanting to mess with how other people live or feel.
He becomes less self-centered. He realizes
not really. He still doesn't really care in any real way. He doesn't want to. He doesn't embrace this other culture. He starts changing them, and he doesn't even realize that he's doing it. And he says, like, you know, we're not here to change them. But that's exactly what he's doing the whole time.
Well, but, I mean, I'm not even just thinking about, you know, his reaction to, you know, the indigenous population, but also his reaction to the love interest and the friend. And
sure, they use a human proxy for his relation to the rest of the world.
Yeah,
and it stops there. And like, if it was just a human proxy for his attachment to the rest of the world, that would be fine. But like Neo, his attachment to that one individual does not expand outwardly to include everyone else. It really does stop there.
Well, that could be. I mean, but I guess you've also got to figure that they're telling a crazy little comedy, and comedies, you know, tend to be short. I mean, you know, people always say a comedy shouldn't be more than, you know, 90 minutes or whatever.
You're saying that the reason that it doesn't show these other changes is because it was too involved for the time?
I'm trying to say that you know, you need to use a certain level of shorthand in order to get your point across as a filmmaker.
And I think that when you rely on a shorthand that is not logically rigorous, you end up with a movie that seems to be saying, screw it.
I don't know. I mean, I definitely understood what the you know, themes in the movie were. I think
the intention doesn't matter. I mean, what matters is that the intention isn't accomplished by the mechanics at play.
Well, I would disagree. I would say that it successfully conveyed its point. I didn't like the movie. I didn't think it was very good. I thought it was very uneven, especially in terms of the comedy, which I didn't think was very funny. And yeah, on the whole, it's not a good movie. 3 years later, he got another shot at directing, this time a much different movie, one for Merchant Ivory, and that was The Deceivers, starring Pierce Brosnan as a British officer who is in India and tries to uncover a...
He's trying to infiltrate a criminal organization in order to prove that they, one, exist... Mm-hmm. And two are criminals.
Yeah. And so he goes undercover and joins the Tuggy cult.
Yep.
Which is a group of thieves and murderers.
You've seen Temple of Doom. You know what the Tuggy cult is.
And hijinks ensue. This movie, I thought, was interesting in that it was visually much more... ambitious than most of Myers' movies, although I thought that the photography on the whole, like the lighting and stuff, was pretty bad, but like his camera movement and everything was a lot more aggressive. And Pierce Brosnan was, you know, good in it and everything, but on the whole, I did not find the story to be all that compelling.
Yeah, I think that's nuts. This is definitely my favorite of Nicholas Meyer's non-Star Trek movies. And it's because it's just weird. It's just super weird. Like 20 or so minutes into the movie, I realized that it was a guy goes undercover into the mob story. And like his loyalty gets questioned and he doesn't know which person he really is. That story in that context was very interesting. I was very into the idea of this radical departure for that genre. And I would really love it if somebody would recognize that it's that genre. And like if it was in like a row of undercover cop movies, I would really like that, because it is an undercover cop movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And by putting this kind of story into this context, it made the story work better. Because I've seen the undercover cop goes into the mob story so many times that I know all the beats before the first frame rolls. So him being in the thuggy cult and like the weird sort of almost supernatural qualities, that was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I always like it when movies do that. And on the whole, I agree with what you're saying about that type of filmmaking. With this particular scenario, I don't think that it works well because I think that the story that they're telling is not very interesting. But, next movie, which Meyer directed, came another 3 years later, and this was September 1991. And that was Company Business, starring Gene Hackman and Mikhail Baryshnikov, about two spies at the end of the Cold War.
After the Cold War.
Yeah, who must team up in order to survive.
They've torn down the wall, but they haven't exported all the bricks everywhere.
Yeah.
They don't know where to put most of them because they're really heavy bricks.
Yeah. So what did you think about Company Business?
I was into it. I was into it for a big chunk of the time, and then I realized that it wasn't going to do anything particularly interesting. That the obvious like assumption that the particular spy game that they were involved in was kind of the expected mystery. The particular crime was sort of obvious. It seemed so obvious that I discounted it, and then when it turned out to be that, I was kind of like, oh, I guess that's okay. And then it ended while I was blinking.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that was really weird. There was no conclusion.
Yeah, structurally it might have some problems. I think on the whole, it is a pretty good movie. It's not a great movie or anything like that, but, it's decent. I found it to be rather compelling throughout as sort of a mindless suspense thriller type of thing. I can see what he was going for in terms of, you know, kind of like a message. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately it didn't really say all that much, and he was able to tackle that subject much more thoroughly with his next movie, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which came out a couple months later, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, I mean, on the whole, I thought that this movie was very well crafted. The ending is weird. I think that he was trying something kind of bold with it, and ultimately it didn't work.
Well, there are a lot of things about it that I'm very much in favor of. I really like I think that the context of like the end of the Cold War, it's a very interesting time because it's one of those transitional periods where you've got so many loose ends. You've sort of got the components to do stories set afterwards and set beforehand. So you've got the two worlds, and you can sort of move throughout those two sort of like story frameworks in whatever is necessary. And the story is essentially kind of about how things stay the same, how things become, how an institution becomes sort of self-sustaining, and the necessary evil that you commit one day might require you to just keep doing it. So that's an interesting thing, and it isn't helped by the spy movie trappings. It isn't helped by Gene Hackman being an old spy coming in out of the cold. It isn't helped by the prisoner transfer in the underground tunnel. Like those things just get in the way. It's really about the KGB and the CIA collaborating to keep themselves both in business.
Yeah.
That's the story. And in a way, I think it would have benefited much better from not having the two spies on the run story, which is where the story, like, starts and ends. And everything that's happening elsewhere is more interesting than these two guys on the run. Because their two guys on the run story is not as funny as if it was Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. And it's not as action-packed as if it was Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. It's basically kind of everything cut in half. And almost everything else in the story is more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I think that, you know, you need to find a way to do that story, and his idea was to tell it, you know, through these people's eyes, which I think is a perfectly reasonable thing to try for. But I think, you know, the problem that it runs into is that, you know, the focus becomes them, and it sort of loses its message in an attempt to tell their story as well as it possibly can.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I did like it. I know that you know, Meyer thinks it's his worst movie, and I don't agree with that at all. But I can see how he would be disappointed in the finished product. 2 months later, another Meyer movie was released, and that was Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
I've heard of that movie.
Very similar to Company Business in terms of its themes. About the end of the Cold War and everything, and the idea of these cold warriors no longer having a place in the world. So what are your thoughts on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country?
I think it has lots of far-reaching implications, much farther than an extremely in-depth analysis of the Cold War.
Okay.
Extremely in-depth analysis of the Cold War will take you so far. Star Trek VI will take you farther, because it's about things that are more abstract.
Sure.
Than stuff that occurred.
Yeah, it's got a lot of stuff going on. Yeah.
Right. So it's a very good movie about a whole bunch of things, in the way that Star Trek II is about a whole bunch of things. People love to reduce things down to a nub, and there are plenty of contexts in which that's totally appropriate. Nicholas Meyer's Star Trek movies are not those. It's almost impossible to reduce them down to a thing. It's about so many different things, and it's expertly put together, and the only reason Star Trek II is slightly better than Star Trek VI is because Star Trek VI is slightly burdened by being the last film in the original cast series.
Yeah, I don't see how that's a burden, and I also don't see Star Trek.
It's a burden. It's a burden towards the end when Scotty shoots the assassin.
Star Trek VI.
And they pull the mask off of the guy, and they all stand up on the stage. That's kind of ridiculous.
It's perfectly fine and a perfectly reasonable conclusion to this franchise, which has existed for, at that point, 25 years. Yeah, Star Trek VI is my favorite Meyer movie, and it's also one of my favorite Star Trek anythings of all time. I do think that it's better than Wrath of Khan. Because I think a big part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, Meyer had a good 9 years to hone his craft. And I think that what we're seeing is, you know, all these other movies that he did in between Star Trek II and Star Trek VI were him, you know, figuring out how to be a director. And if you look at Star Trek VI, it's a much more polished movie in pretty much every respect.
Star Trek VI is like a perfectly well-made pocket watch, and Star Trek II, like you could argue, and I would be perfectly okay with it, that it's like a grandfather clock, but it also tells you the future.
I mean, I'm not going to argue, you know, the quality of Star Trek II. I'm just saying that, you know, I prefer Star Trek VI. Star Trek VI says more to me, and I'm also more impressed by its craftsmanship. After that, he took a break, and it was 8 years until he made what at this point is his final movie, and that's Vendetta, which was a return to television, this time HBO, to tell the story of the largest lynching in American history, about some Italian immigrants in New Orleans in the 1890s, I believe, who basically had their business stolen from them by some rich American businessmen.
One of them is played by Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Who's the most Italian actor in Hollywood right now.
And he, you know, basically set them up to take the fall so that he could take over their businesses. And everyone was completely okay with it.
There's more at play there, but it's also kind of pointlessly more. Okay. It's like a lot of different chess pieces being moved around. Mm-hmm. But they're being used by, like, a child. So they're hopping over each other because they don't know how to play checkers.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with that. I mean, I can see how in some ways it's one of the lesser Meyer works because it doesn't have, you know, the complexities of some of his movies. But I also think that, you know, again, like Star Trek VI, he's comfortable enough that he knows how to tell a story, you know, relatively well. I wish he would have sort of been a bit more ambitious in terms of his, you know, visual storytelling here, but I think he was kind of scared by the material, like by being like sort of reverential to the material.
I think that's a significant, very huge problem in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an aspect to dealing with a historical event, especially a tragic event, or an event that deals with bigotry of some kind. There's always this urge to be reverent, this urge to be extremely respectful. And if you're overly respectful, then you end up making the victims of the bigotry perfect, and the perpetrators of the bigotry demons.
Yeah.
And by doing that, and that is what he did here, unfortunately, he did essentially submit to all of the sort of like internal psychological pressures of dealing with something serious.
Mm-hmm.
And that is hugely crippling because it makes the protagonist, and I said this in the episode, it makes the protagonist look like a cartoon.
But I think at the same time, the story which he's telling is a really interesting one. And for that reason, I would recommend watching this movie.
I don't recommend watching this movie. And I find it very sad that he thinks it's his best movie. I think that's really not a good thing.
So that was it for Nicholas Meyer's career. 8 movies over the span of 20 years. Any final thoughts on Nicholas Meyer as a director?
On the Vendetta episode, we talked about how he hasn't made a movie since Vendetta. And I said, and I'll reiterate that here, that I think it's bad when you say that your favorite movie of your own is the one that is the least impressive. His other movies, you know, better or worse, you know, doesn't matter so much. They're not particularly, I mean, the bad ones aren't particularly, you know, astonishing, but they're more impressive in other ways. Vendetta feels almost amateurish by comparison to his other work. And that, I imagine, if I was running a studio and I heard Nicholas Meyer say that his favorite movie of his own work was Vendetta, I would be hesitant to greenlight a project. Because that sounds like something a crazy person would say.
Okay, well, I, on the whole, am very impressed with Meyer's career as a director. I think that he's one of the greats and one of the great overlooked directors. I think a lot of people sort of are just completely unaware of what it is that he's done outside of Star Trek. Star Trek fans don't pay attention to what's going on outside of Star Trek, and fans of his other movies, I think, aren't really the type of people who would normally watch Star Trek movies. So he kind of gets he kind of falls through the cracks. You know, I think that he's a one-hit wonder to many people, but the one hit is different for everyone else.
Right. Everybody sees him as a one-hit wonder, but none of those people can agree on what that hit is.
Right. And in the reality of the situation is, you know, he's made a career of one hits. And if you look at what a career of one hits are, it's a pretty solid career, you know?
He only had one hit comedy.
Yeah.
One hit action movie.
Right.
One hit thriller.
Yeah.
One hit Merchant Diary crazy shit.
Exactly. That's how I see Meyer's career. You know, once you take a look at all of his movies on the whole, you see that he is quite a great filmmaker. And I really wish that someone would say, yes, Nicholas Meyer, here's some money. Go make another movie.
And I think
apparently
that
has a movie coming out in 2014 called Love Affair.
Yeah.
I really hope that it gets made. And apparently it's being shot in Chicago. Which is cool.
I think that the only thing that needs to happen for Nicholas Meyer to be recognized as a very amazing filmmaker is for people to say, Star Trek is just fine. There's nothing weird about it. It's normal now. You're not a weirdo who made two Star Trek movies. You just worked in that Star Trek series.
All right. Well, that's the end of Nicholas Meyer as a director. I think that's pretty much it for Nicholas Meyer on this show for the time being. I can't really think of anything else that we can cover with him. So it's been great to look at this guy's career, both as a director and an author. As always, you can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com, or you can find our other show on our website, CommentaryTrackStars.com.